This is Sunday Nights, exploring religion, ethics and society with John Cleary.
It's amazingly potent, the culture.
On ABC Local Radio.
It's great to welcome back now an old friend of we here in the religion unit of the ABC, Reverend Dr. David Milliken, who once stood the other side of this chair as my boss. David, welcome back to Sunday Night.
It's terrific to be here, John, and you're doing very well.
David, you're the person who actually got this program started.
It's true.
And we've had terrific. A sort of an up and down ride since then, but we're still here. Now, you're actually here to talk about another aspect of culture entirely, that is a religious short film prize.
Yes.
The emphasis being on the word religious, not Christian in particular, sponsored, though, by the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture. Now, put these two things together for us.
Okay, well, look, I actually was the founding director of that organisation. So they are associated with Charles Sturt University. It's a broadly ecumenical group that's trying to build a centre in Canberra on some land that was given to the churches in 1920. So that the centre came out of a very close relationship between George Browning.
And the Anglican bishop at the time.
That's right, and the Catholic bishop, Bishop Frank. And they were very good friends, and they said, well, let's make it an ecumenical venture. There it was.
So they are now promoting a religious rather than a Christian short film festival.
I've had a life in film on and off. You know, I've made films, and I rather enjoy it. And all the other arts have got their prizes. There's prizes for writing and for art and poetry and so on, but nothing for films. Well, not one that was broad in its understanding. There's a couple of Christian ones, you know, but I wanted to reach out because I believe film is very potent in its capacity to render deep understandings and questions about the nature of the human condition, which go beyond philosophy and which really only religion can deal with. You know that film Leviathan, that wonderful Russian film? There's a religious film.
Yes.
I mean, damn it, that film is full of such extraordinary complexity. Moral complexity. Everyone is compromised in that film, and yet at the same time there's a deep sort of passion in it.
Or even a wonderful film like Babette's Feast of 20 years ago.
Of course. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for those pieces, 8 minutes long. We're following fairly ruthlessly the model of the Tropfest. And it's got to deal with that aspect of the human condition, that search for spirituality or a commentary on religion. We'll accept anything in any form. We won't accept anything that's sort of gratuitously blasphemous. Or
the search for personal meaning.
Personal meaning, maybe, or the search for the divine.
However you wish to define that.
Indeed. Indeed. This is the problem the Blake Prize has always had, you know. What is a religious painting? You know, what is a religious film? What's religious music? You know, it's a very complex but wondrous question.
So this is going to take place when?
Well,
it's open now,
It is. It's open. And there's a website which is creativitypillar.org.au.
And when do entries have to be in by?
Charles Sturt University, put in short film prize and so on.
When do entries have to be in by?
End of Feb.
End of February. So it's good that we're talking to you just before Christmas.
Indeed,
so people can get their entries in or get working very hard. Now, just underlying this, and you alluded to it, you have a long background in thinking about religion. Indeed, you were here as the head of the religion unit in the ABC for some time. We're leading up to Christmas, following a period of extraordinary tension in religious communities, particularly over what is Islam in Australia today. Is that perhaps the most significant discussion about religion that this country has had at a public level for some time? And is it raising questions? Is it raising questions that people really do have to take serious?
Oh, John, you surprised me, because that is really, I'm surprised that you have elevated the moment and the to that sort of level.
No, I'm reflecting the way headlines are treated.
Yes. I don't see much discussion, really.
Mm.
I see a lot of declamatory remarks, people jockeying to use the situation, you know. And that constant demand on the Islamic leadership to keep saying we're against this, we're against this, we're peaceful, and then being told they've got to mean it, you know. That sort of stuff is not discussion, really. I think we've had bigger discussions. I wish it was a more coherent discussion, because we've got a lot to talk about between each other, you know. And when you look at what has been going on in Paris and in the US and so forth, you can see that the world out there is really struggling to come to terms with, even to describe what it is, what's going on. And the big elephant in the room is always this thing about the nature of human beings themselves and the presence of evil within people, and to what extent are they responsible for their actions. Those are, if we're going to understand what's going on, they are the big questions, and they are the questions that religion answers. I don't see anyone else answering them.
Different faith traditions have different responses to that.
Of course they do.
I mean, this goes back to the question of how you begin that dialogue. Because most of those, if you get into a serious discussion, last week there was the Islamophobia conference in Sydney, and it brought together people at really about three levels. You had scholars of national and international repute, you had community leaders, and you had sort of grassroots type activists and people. And almost universally, people were saying the real answer to this is found at the grassroots, but people getting to know each other and talking to each other. And it's there you find out just who and what you are in relationship. But that seems to be the one thing that nobody has a really good idea about how to pull off.
Oh, look, I don't know about that, John. I would say every week in Sydney there would be a handful of groups meeting between Christians and Muslims, for example. There may be other faith traditions that are doing that, but I know about them. And that it is simply that, people who are now at a stage where they're sharing food, they're talking, they've got to know each other and so forth. Last Sunday at my church, I had three prominent Muslim people, a brother and his two sisters, Ali Rudi, Nada, well-known, often the go-to man on television and so forth, and another sister, Alma. And they faced 40 of my church's congregation. And I had people in my church who said, oh, David, Muslims frighten me. I said, do you know any? They said, no. And I actually asked, in church, I said, how many of you know any Muslims? And there's only a couple of hands go up, you see. So it was terrific.
But there aren't many vehicles. If you take away the church, you know, the church, the churches are one of the few vehicles left that bring sort of local grassroots people together with the sort of upper echelons of their cultural strands. And the old groups, like the old grassroots community groups, are all struggling these days. Churches are struggling too. But it's that means of how you affect exactly the sort of things you're talking about. It's almost like you're asking every local Christian community, if you like, to go out and befriend people in a local mosque or begin to deal with each other. That's a big ask, particularly at a time when community groups are struggling for their own identity.
I know. See, I mean, look, I got to know a fella who had a lot to do with the Al Rizala bookshop, right? One, the centre of radical recruitment and fundamentalism in Sydney. Over a couple of years, he and I became friends. And it was an extraordinary experience, because I used to go in there and say, give me a book, I'll read it, and can we talk? And after a while, we were talking theology, and I said, I want to get inside your head. I want to understand why you're prepared to go and live in the caliphate, you see. And a lot of guys around him were doing that. And I saw them on Skype saying, this is fabulous. I'm going to bring my family. This is the... and so on. So now, in a similar situation, a group of those fellows a couple of years before had decided to come over and visit me when I was minister in Balmain. They're driving up Montague Street. The cops stop them, walk around the car, come around to the window and say, what are you bastards doing here? And it just went from bad to worse. See, so they, in a sense, it's at that level that we've got to deal with this, because they feel as though, as they come under greater attention, they're being pushed into this area, you know, and they don't feel welcome.
Let's take religious communities as an example of groups that can possibly be bridges, bridge builders.
Yes.
Most people have grown up in churches, perhaps for the last half century, that are intent on describing who they are as a closed community. This is what we believe.
Yes.
This is the doctrines we have. This is what you shall believe.
Yes.
The emphasis has been on right thought rather than right action. And that still exists for many, many, and right across the denominations. You could go to it from Hillsong on one end to conservative Calvinism, Catholicism at another end.
No, they all do that. I agree with that, John.
And that happens in the Muslim communities too.
Yes, I think it is. It's of the nature of religious communities in a way is that they define themselves by exclusion.
Because they're holding
we're
on.
We're here and you're out there. You're
because
not.
They're holding on to a heritage that's deep. And they want to preserve that against the corrupting influences of modernity.
Look, you've got to preserve your own heritage. In fact, in some ways, we don't do enough of it. Because all the big arguments are all there throughout the church's history. And the more we know about that history, I think the wiser we become in our present circumstances. So that's important. But I agree with you. If a person's going to join a church, they've got to stand in the doorway, look in and say, they're my people. Now, I have trouble doing that. I go there and think, what am I doing? You know, this funny business we go on. You stand up and we sing and then we sit down. I've had friends of mine come along and they're totally bemused and in a sense lost. Mm. So, I mean, a lot of churches try and deal with this by having groups and so forth, but that central model, I agree with you.
David, let's pause for a moment and have a piece have a piece of music. What would you like? We opened with Messiah, with the Amen, the conclusion of the Messiah.
That was a bit perverse, I guess. let's go for the middle of a piece. I've Become Bewitched by Shostakovich. I think he's the greatest composer of the 20th century. And if ever there's a man who pierces right in between marrow and bone, you know, to the basic issues, it's Dmitri Shostakovich. And he is capable of writing the most sublimely beautiful things and very tempestuous things. But the one of the most beautiful would be the second movement of his second piano concerto.
Thank you.
Shostakovich.
Yes.
A selection of our guest, the Reverend Dr. David Millikan. David, we spoke just before that that beautiful piece of music about the problems that faith communities have in reaching out. But there's a sense in which, for all faith communities, whether it's the Abrahamic communities of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, or even Hinduism, Buddhism, the essence of the origin of those communities was stepping outside the closed group into and opening yourself to the world. It was a way about living in the world, about changing the world, in fact.
It certainly was with the early Christians. You can see that. They did not change their way of life. They changed certain habits. They met regularly together, but they still were going at 10 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, as best they could to the temple. And they were still participating in the sacrifices. And those that were Jews were maintaining probably even more scrupulously. And they raised extraordinary comment because the people saw them, watched this sort of radical change that happened in them. So that is a model of a church that really has no walls. But if you come under persecution and when you gain assets and you've got to make decisions as to who does what and where and so on, then up go the bureaucratic structures. And they, by their very nature, you know, are concerned about themselves.
So is institutional religion in strife today?
Look, mainstream religion in Australia, except in a couple of quite interesting areas, is in what would now appear to be an almost terminal decline. There is this view around that says there is a sort of line, and when a church dips below that line in terms of numbers, age, resources, or smarts, knowledge, if it gets below that line,
below the critical mass,
it will not come back. And no matter, you can put your best people in there and so forth, but I think it's happening in quite a few places around Australia.
So where does religion go? I mean, why do you hang in there?
Well, I hang in there because I am both personally extremely fascinated by the whole journey of faith, but also because I find that today there's more interest in religion than I've ever experienced. For example, some weeks ago, in response to the word evil being thrown around, oh, so-and-so was evil, this is evil, the Prime Minister was saying it was evil. And every time he said evil, we got sort of more of our human rights snatched from us. So I suggested to the community where I live in Bury, south of Sydney, that we have a public discussion about evil. So 60 people turn up and it's on for young and old, but serious stuff. And you can see people just saying, oh, good grief, at last, you know, there's some place where
So the institutional rights don't hold, but the issues of substance continue.
Oh, of course they do. Good grief, we're screaming at them. The public debate in Australia just... Look, the churches are letting Australia down. They're hiding and sort of desperately trying to preserve their own sort of dignity and existence. They should be out there. They should be pushing their best brains, their best communicators out there and say, let's have these discussions. We have got something to say.
Is that in part because the churches, for the best part, again, of the last 100 years, perhaps the last 50 years, have divorced themselves from civil society? That is, they've played the game that the politicians have asked them to play and keep themselves towards the sort of discussions of personal morality or private morality and left the civic square behind.
Yeah, look, I think that is a factor. I also think there's some deep sort of psychological issues in a broader sense operating, because the church has slowly lost its place of privilege in lots of ways, and in a sense it has been pushed bit by bit off to the edges. And you either fight back and say, we've got something to say, or you can retreat and say, well, look, we're going to preserve our own situation here. And I think that's what's happened. They've got out of the way
of
apologetics.
A lack of confidence?
Yeah, and I think also a type of intellectual... There's been a sort of intellectual problem for the last 100 years, the great liberal theological experiment, devastating influence on the confidence of theological thought, because a lot of people began to wonder what it was they actually believed. And if you're in that state, you know, it makes hard, you don't want to sort of go out and say, oh, let me tell you what it's like to be a Christian, you know, when you're struggling. And especially my church, the Uniting Church, that really was devastated.
And in the typical way that such arguments go, the moment you state a position which with a lot of people may agree or disagree, you polarise. So you either become a liberal or a fundamentalist. The middle can't hold.
Yeah. Look, it was a fascinating situation. I went to one church at the selection committee. There was a couple of barristers there and so forth, you know. And this was a church known to be extremely liberal. Wasn't sure that the creeds were worth talking about and all that sort of stuff. And someone asked me, did you believe that Jesus rose from the dead? I said, now, look, let's cut to the chase here, right? I said, because this could save us a lot of time. I said, I believe that Jesus died for my sins, that he rose on the third day. And they're aghast at this sort of orthodox talk. And it was on. The most extraordinary conversation. And about 20 minutes later, the chairman said, we've got to stick to the point. If it's going to be like this, I want him. And so I had this amazing relationship where people would come up to me after I'd preached and say, we don't believe any of that, David. And I said, well, here's the challenge. We have got to learn to love each other and live with each other. I said, everyone's waiting for us to fight. I refuse to do it. Mm. This is about the ideas. So we had a terrific time. But that whole Jesus seminar thing, you know, they're all Jack Spong and all that. It was asking a lot of really serious questions, but in the end, I think it's been really destructive.
Yes, it at some point it boiled down to a series of diverse personal opinions.
Oh, indeed, yes. And in a way, it re-established the tyranny of scholarship, because when you picked up the Bible, the New Testament, you would say, "Oh, here we go," and you say, "Oh, I think Martin Bork said that's not true," or Crossan says, "Oh, yes, it is," or so forth. So you had to, in a sense, you lost your capacity for simply reading.
Of discernment, yes.
And with any type of certainty. And you had to go back and read, you know, what you were allowed to believe in and what you didn't, you know, and so on.
That doesn't mean you trash scholarship, though, does it?
Oh, good grief. It's scholarship that wins the day in that debate, actually. Because, like, in the last 20 years, there has been an explosion of biblical scholarship, more than I've ever seen.
And even in Orthodox scholarship, like N.T. Wright.
Oh, it's
like the
most extraordinary level of stuff that's pouring out. And in a way, that whole sort of liberal experiment has just been sort of shuffled aside. It's not even mentioned. It's not. It was, in the end, tawdry, I'm afraid.
So what are we looking at now in contemporary Australia? At one end you have the charismatic worshipping communities like Hillsong and others who, at a business level at least, are incredibly successful, have a world market before them through their music ministry. At another end you have those in both Catholicism and Protestantism saying, no, we actually have to be a church that reconnects with the world, and you get that at a sort of it's almost an interchurch network of people who think that they've got to begin to reconnect the emerging church movement, if you want to call it that. Yes. At the other end, you have those who still want to hang on to the sort of liturgy and rituals that are becoming increasingly disconnected from wider society.
Well, it's so diverse, isn't it? I mean, if you some of the finest liturgical exponents have introduced a sense of beauty, which in itself is enduring and universal, I believe. And at that level, they have a terribly important place in the new church. The Christ Church is up here, St. Lawrence. You know that they must endure.
Christ Church, St. Lawrence in Sydney at Railway Square, the highest of high church liturgies done with the utmost refinement.
That's right, indeed. And And there are it's like a symbol. There are people who flood in there on major liturgical moments who never go to church but sit there just entranced and elevated and given access. So I think the church is going to have to take all manner of forms. I certainly don't think Hillsong is the saviour of the Australian church. I have a lot of problems with Hillsong. In fact, I think it is actually putting the cause backwards in lots of ways.
Do you mean that as a style or as a particular group of people?
Oh, no, as a style. So that sort of...
rock anthem for Jesus approach to worship.
Yeah, the Word of Faith movement, which is very influential. I mean, one of the promises that is fundamental to the gospel is the promise of the abundant life in all its forms. And in a sense,
that gets perverted into the prosperity gospel.
It does, it does. And it's an antidote to the fears of the middle class. The middle class is under threat. And all those old values of hard work, honesty, thrift, and so on, they mean nothing. You still go backwards. And then Hillsong says you don't have to worry. And so it's beautifully structured really to address that really, I think, a very deep fear in a lot of Western cultures as the middle class shrink and disappear.
Some people would critique it too as being what they would term religion captured at an adolescent moment.
It is. It
focuses on the strong emotion of the moment.
Yes. Oh, look, you will get no great Luthers. You won't get any Augustines, St. Thomas Aquinas's. You won't get that out of the charismatic movement. And it's a movement, at one level, is even disrespectful of intense scholarship because it believes that knowledge is accessed in another way, you know, directly through the Holy Spirit.
Intuitive.
And so forth. Yes, yes.
Although that is changing. I mean, you do see groups that are on the margins of the charismatic church.
No,
Southern Cross College and places like that are beginning to actually produce some quite good scholars.
No, well said.
Table College too. Have
yes.
All right. Now we've got to wind this conversation up.
Okay.
We've gone rather broadly across the world of religion, but it actually is the reason is to focus in or to give us a way of talking about religion and film. The reason you're running this, you clearly see that religion still has an important place in the landscape of our culture
more than ever. And I see all manner of manifestations of it out there. There's sort of hunger for that. So it's for that reason. It's being circulated around the Islamic community. The Buddhist Film Festival is on side. The Baha'is and all of them. And so because in this current age, one of the fundamental points of contact between all religions is that we believe that this world does not exhaust reality. Now, in there is both a tyranny and a salvation, really. But how do we get to see that in discuss it? Film, I think, is a perfect medium. And Ed Spess does it wonderfully.
All right, let's talk about how it's going to be judged. What happens? People will put their films in, and you and a group of people will sit around and say, "We like this one."
Yes. We'll choose half a dozen.
So you have a judging panel.
Yeah, we have a judging panel, which is me, of course, and Dr. Susan Murphy Roshi. She runs the Buddhist Film Festival, and is a leading Zen Roshi in Australia. We have the lady who set up the Short Black Festival, and Teresa Chachalis. So it'll be us three, and we will find someone of note in the industry, I guess.
So a panel of four.
Yes.
Get your entries in by when?
The end of February.
End of February.
Yes, and go to that website because they're all the entry forms, discussions about all the questions that this raises. The website is Creativity Pillar.
Creativity Pillar.
Funny name, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
There it is. Creativitypillar.org.au.
Reverend Dr. David Milliken, great to have you back.
John, a pleasure.
And we're going to have a piece of music to finish with. And again, the choice is yours.
Look, again, I'm showing my soft side here, John. It's just a gorgeous, lilting little lullaby by John Rutter. It's called Mary's Lullaby.
John Rutter, Mary's Lullaby. David Milliken, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, John.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.